Shea.
A leading health think tank has said the NHS will face its tightest spending period in 40 years, whoever wins the general election. The Nuffield Trust says all the main parties need to be more transparent in their promises. The Shadow Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, says Labour's manifesto would be followed after the election by spending reviews and budgets that could result in further policies. The Transport Secretary, Mark Harper, says the Conservatives would deliver a record number of doctors and nurses. The Lib Dems say taxing big banks would mean they can increase GP numbers by 8,000. World leaders at the Ukraine summit in Switzerland are due to issue their final communique. The draft says the war between Russia and Ukraine is responsible for widespread suffering and destruction, and it reaffirms the territorial integrity of all states. The Israeli military says it will hold a daily tactical pause of military activity in part of southern Gaza to allow more humanitarian aid into the territory. The suspension comes after 8 soldiers were killed in Rafah. Police in the city of Round Rock in Texas say 2 people have died after a dispute escalated into a shootout during festivities in a park. The victims may not have been directly involved in the altercation, which happened at a celebration of the upcoming anniversary of the abolition of slavery in the United States. The German sportswear multinational Adidas is investigating allegations by whistleblowers of large-scale bribery among some managers in China. The Financial Times says Adidas employees there claim staff have been embezzling the equivalent of millions of pounds. Adidas told the FT it was committed to complying with regulations and ethical standards in all its markets. China's Premier Li Qiang says he'll send 2 new pandas to Adelaide Zoo as Beijing looks to cement improving ties with Australia. Mr. Li made the offer during his 4-day visit to the country, the first by a Chinese leader in 7 years. The Prince and Princess of Wales have released an official photo to mark Father's Day. The picture, taken by Catherine on a beach in Norfolk, shows Prince William wearing a baseball cap with his arms around their 3 children. And the weather, cloudy and rainy in the north. There's a chance of lightning in eastern areas. In the south, there'll be scattered showers and sunny spells. That's the news and weather at 12:02. Now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Frank Gardner is the BBC's security correspondent, familiar to millions of us from his reports, which regularly take him around the world. He's also written 6 books, including a memoir about his 25 years in the Middle East, and more recently, 4 novels about the adventures of MI6 operative Luke Carlton. The latest, Invasion, focuses on the tensions between China and Taiwan. In 2004, while filming in Saudi Arabia, Frank and his cameraman, Simon Cumbers, were ambushed by Al-Qaeda gunmen. Simon was killed and Frank was shot 6 times and left for dead. He survived but was partially paralysed. He returned to reporting within a year using a wheelchair. Frank, you've brought us a wide array of music from Vaughan Williams and Shostakovich to Fats Waller, but we're going to start with Schumann.
Yes, my father was a very accomplished pianist. He was a hopeless violinist. He took up the violin very late in life and never realised quite how bad he was at that, but he was a superb pianist, both at playing and composing. And one of my earliest memories musically, I was playing cards, I think with my mother, and there were these lovely playing cards with, on the back of each was a different tropical bird, mostly birds of paradise. And in the other room, my father was playing Schumann's Carnival, and I called it the Faraway Bird Song. I was 7 at the time.
Which one have you homed in on?
Reconnaissance, because I will always associate it with those exotic birds, which helped kindle a love of birds in me and eventually took me to Papua New Guinea about 5 years ago.
Let's take flight then with Schumann. Thank you. Reconnaissance from Robert Schumann's Carnival, performed by Stephen Hough. Frank Gardner, your parents were diplomats.
Yes, they were both diplomats. My mother was only the third woman to get into the Foreign Office. She was a Cambridge scholar, but at the time, I think she faced a lot of sexism and misogyny and a sort of, oh, well done you, you're a girl, you've got in kind of thing. You can just imagine the sort of Bufton Tuftons that would have been stalking the corridors of King Charles Street in 1950. And she was asked, where would you like to be posted to? She said, well, anywhere except behind the Iron Curtain. Right, Budapest for you. And she loved it. She was there at a time of the worst communist excesses. You know, Stalin was still alive. Hungarian friends of hers were being internally deported, you know, bang on the door, 4 a.m, off into the truck, interrogation, and then taken off to a different part of the country. But she kept in touch with them, and she never forgot her Hungarian. She died 10 years ago, and to her dying day, at 91, she was able to hold a conversation in Hungarian. I took her back to Budapest 40 years after she'd been there, and we crossed the Chechenyi, the chain bridge over the Danube, quite late in the evening, and her eyes filled with tears. She said, I never thought I would see a Hungary free from communism. She just didn't think she'd live to see that day.
You spent quite a bit of your early life in the Netherlands, didn't you?
Well, my dad was posted to The Hague, so I lived there from the age of 6 till 9. These were very formative years. I have nothing but happy memories of living in the Netherlands. I was made to learn some Dutch. I learnt one really useful phrase, which is Ik weet alleen een beetje Hollands onder de mijn Engels. I only know a little Dutch because I'm English. And it always brings a smile. And it's where I got my love of birdwatching from. My mother got me into it, and we'd go to these sort of remote, windy North Sea islands, blasted by wind with almost no trees. But then we'd see a flock of avocets or something like that. And one of my most vivid memories is skating along the dikes. They hardly ever freeze now, I'm told. But back then, they froze, and I could never keep up with my parents. They were pretty good at it. But we'd skate past these windmills.
You're conjuring up a wonderfully Bruegel-like picture for me.
Do you know, you're very astute. It was exactly like that. We skated on huge big lakes and then went for sort of warm cheese, Gouda cheese somewhere.
You brought us a wonderful photograph of your dad from 1946.
Yes, he was still in his captain's uniform from Second World War. He hadn't quite been demobbed, but he can't have had much to do militarily, I think, in that year, because he managed to win the Cheltenham Gold Cup for piano composition. So it's a photograph of him, real creamed and glossy, being presented with this great big gold cup. He joined the intelligence corps because he had German, so he was quite a long way from the front lines. But he wrote a fascinating war diary, which I've still got. I've just been rereading it, actually, his description of June the 6th, of course, D-Day. He said it was a thrilling sight as they gathered on the south coast to see these waves of gliders going over, being towed, knowing that the invasion had begun.
There are not many guests that are able to bring us music by their dad, but you have.
Yes, he composed quite a bit. I mean, he was immensely happy to retire from the diplomatic service at 55 and devoted himself to music. And he had music performed on the South Bank at the Royal Festival Hall, which I went along to in the 1980s. And that was a very proud moment.
Well, let's hear from the Concerto for Oboe and Strings by Neil Gardner, Alla Marcia. Thank you.
To say the several times there, I thought, where are you going with this exactly? And several times I thought, right, well, that's finished. Oh, no, not quite. To me, it conjures up a field of rabbits where they're hopping around in a kind of rather random way. And my father's piano, he had a grand piano, which my daughter has inherited, she plays, and he had a window right beside him, which looked out on the field and the pond. And he had a great love of the countryside. We moved to Hampshire. He loved watching the moorhens on the pond, all the rabbits playing, all the mallards. And he had names for them, and he'd go and feed them in the mornings. I don't think they wanted to be fed, but that piece rather makes me think of them just hopping around in a random, disorganised way.
The Allemachel from the Concerto for Oboe and Strings by Neil Gardner, performed by Andrew Knight on the oboe, and members of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Barry Wordsworth. Frank Gardner, it sounds then as if you were quite close to your parents, yet you, at a very tender age, sent off to boarding school.
At the time, I thought this was normal. It's what all my friends did. I was sent off at the age of 8. This is going to sound odd from coming from someone who was shot, but I think I dodged a bullet at least at that stage of my life. Mm. It was a lovely place, a place called St. Ronan's, still going strong. There was absolutely no abuse or cruelty that I was aware of at all. I mean, we got turfed out on cold winter's days to do cross-country runs, but I loved that. It became my shtick, cross-country running or long-distance running. Mm. But I would agree with you that 8 is too young to be sent off to boarding school. Mm. For me, because we lived in the Netherlands at the time, that might as well have been the other side of the planet. And I do remember an enormous sense of abandonment, having been delivered to this strange place with hundreds of boys I didn't know. My parents drove off waving goodbye, and I was suddenly alone there in that first term, and you sink or swim.
I've got to admit that it was music that saved me at that age, because I was sent as a chorister to Westminster Cathedral, so I was in my element. But for you, I think, Frank, it was green sleeves that you associate with it.
Yes, I do. You're quite right. So there was a lovely headmistress, I mean, the headmaster's mother, I guess. And on Sunday, we had to go to chapel twice, in the morning and in the evening. She would always play green sleeves on the organ. That was the end of the weekend. It was the end of the free time you had. Fun was over. Monday morning, it's back to work, as it were. And it was always a tune of great sadness for me because of that.
Well, actually, you've chosen a rather more demanding, technically, piece, which is the Vidor Toccata next.
Oh, no, I mean, that's... I can't think of a more different thing. I mean, it is so uplifting. It's just an exuberance of joy. My daughter is learning the organ at the moment, and I'm really hoping she will learn to play this. My mother introduced me to this bit of music. Musically, I think my parents were a sort of counterpoint to each other in the sense that my father was very technical. He wanted to know exactly which opus it was and which key and so on. But my mother had much more of a feeling for the music. She would say, come and listen to this. How uplifting is this? And Vidor's Toccata was one of those pieces.
exhilarating, isn't it?
Absolutely uplifting.
Charles-Marie Vidor's Toccata, performed there by Wayne Marshall. You mentioned, Frank, that you loved cross-country, and at secondary school you were very athletic.
Yeah, we were very lucky at Marlborough College in having a fantastic athletics and cross-country coach called Bruce Tuller. He'd set the world record for running across the entire breadth of America. Quite a small, slightly built man. He taught biology, but he was a fantastic cross-country coach. And he only died very recently of cancer. And he was a huge impact on my life. In fact, he encouraged me to do my first marathon, which was over the Hog's Back from Guildford. It started uphill, which I thought was really unfair. 3 hours, 56 minutes I did my first one in. So, yeah, cross-country running is something, and I miss it.
How did you come to do a degree in Arabic and Islamic studies at Exeter University?
Everybody I knew spoke French. Quite a lot of my friends had learned Spanish or Italian. But I wanted to choose a difficult but also useful language. The rationale I had at the time was that there were 22 countries that spoke Arabic or some form of it. Quite a lot of them have got oil. Ergo, there ought to be a job at the end of it. I read Jonathan Rabban's Arabia Through the Looking Glass, Thesiger's Marsh Arabs. A lot of these things inspired me, but I realised that this was a vanishing, if not vanished, world, and that I'd have to hurry up if I was going to see any of these places.
And that was just as well, in a way, because you'd caught the travelling bug, hadn't you, fairly early, and had many adventures. Does that sort of curiosity about the world still drive you on?
Absolutely, definitely. I mean, I try and visit a new country or place every year. Last year, I went with friends to Antarctica, which was a trip of a lifetime. Absolutely incredible. You know, when you see your first penguin and your first iceberg, for real, and there are no contrails, and then at dusk, the sky turning pink and the icebergs turning pink, a humpback whale fluking where it dives down and just all you see is this great big Y-shaped tail, then a vast bird with a 10, maybe even 12-foot wingspan riding the wind, and you realise it's your first albatross.
And your next piece of music is a Csárdás.
Yes, so this is a Hungarian connection. I've been going to Hungary since 1982, and a csárda is a sort of country inn. I mean, in the old days, they would have tethered horses there, and they serve very good home-cooked food. Hungarian violin music, I mean, their word for it is gypsy music, and the first time I went there with my mother, we'd go to these wonderful sort of, at the time, smoky cafes where they'd be playing this stuff and the violin would be right in your face. I took my daughter and a friend of hers when they were quite young to Budapest just for a long weekend. The same thing was happening and they were completely freaked out about, you know, having a violin played about 6 inches from their face. There's something very haunting and mysterious about traditional Hungarian music.
Thank you.
Just here in the background there, an instrument called a cimbalom, a percussion instrument, which is, as far as I know, unique to Hungary and Romania. It's a wonderful sound.
You hit it with little
tongs.
Yes, that's
You have to, pair of tongs, yeah. And it's a fantastic language. It's part of the Finno-Ugric group of languages because, of course, they came from way out east, from Mongolia, I think, originally. It has a sort of tone of its own. Nembese maderolongol vodyok. I don't speak Hungarian, I'm English. And it's I love it. I inherited that love of it from my mother.
I always love it when music makes us smile and laugh. You and I were smiling and laughing with those almost Chaplin-esque stop and start and suddenly rush around, you know.
Yeah, it keeps you guessing that.
That was a Csárdás performed by Sándor Lakatos and his gypsy band. You spent, Frank Gardner, as part of your studies, a year in Cairo. It must have been quite an incredible experience to go to that part of the world to live. What were your impressions on finding yourself in that world?
I loved every minute of it. It was brilliant. I mean, later I went back as the BBC bureau chief and that was much harder. I had a young family with me. But as a student, all the things that people sometimes complain about, Cairo, the pollution, the traffic, the noise, the commotion, the smell of urine under the bridges, the pestering in the souks, all of those negative things didn't bother me at all. We lived in a flat, four of us sharing, in quite a sort of nice part called Zamalek. But we would take this little thing called a ma'bar, a little tiny boat that crossed the Nile to a very crowded quarter called Imberba. And there was a favourite cafe I had there, very down to earth, sawdust on the floor, shishas. And I noticed this commotion around the ceiling. Dust was falling, and then suddenly bits of the ceiling gave way and a hoof appeared, then another one, and then finally the whole quarter of the ceiling gave way and a sheep fell to the floor of the cafe, shook itself, looked at us as if to say, "What do you make of that?" and then wandered out into the street. And nobody stopped puffing on their shishas. Everything continued as if this was a completely normal thing, and I loved little moments like that.
And while there, you were taken in by a family.
Yes, by chance I found this family living in a part of Cairo called Gamalia. And if you say that word to Egyptians, they look at you with horror. You stayed in Gamalia?
It's the medieval Islamic part.
It's right in the heart of Islamic Cairo. I mean, I loved it to be living there. There were 12 people crowded into two rooms. I had a sleeping bag and I squashed in with them. In return, I taught their children English. And it was a sort of symbiotic deal in that sense. And during Ramadan, I would fast and then I would feast with them in the evenings and the father would teach me how to cheat at backgammon. they didn't speak a word of English, so it was total immersion. I had to learn Arabic. And the mum, she was called Layla, mother of Layla. When I first knocked on the door, she greeted me with a stern face and folded arms, and she was a big lady. Nam, yes, you know, what do you want? I said, so sorry, but I'd love to look inside a house. I'd not seen inside an Egyptian house. And her face broke into this huge smile and she said, Ahlan wa sahlan, welcome, Betna Betak, our house is your house, come inside. And we became friends after that. I mean, it was a wonderful time.
So it certainly wasn't a case of miserere mei, Dales.
Not at all. No. I only discovered that bit of music much later, thanks to my daughter.
Well, it's by Allegri and it's what we're going to hear next. What do you like about it?
It takes you right up to, in my mind, particularly when the chorister hits that high note, up soaring inside the spires of a cathedral, way above the nave. It just conjures up this almost sort of heavenly ascent. I'm not religious at all, but there's something absolutely heavenly about this piece.
Very interesting quote I saw the other day, that you can be culturally religious.
Yeah.
And still there'll be an atheist.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not an atheist. Yeah. I'm just not particularly religious.
But this piece does transport you.
It does, completely.
Thank you.
The first part of the Allegri Miserere Mei Deus, performed by the soprano Deborah Roberts and the Tallis Scholars, directed by Peter Phillips.
Did you ever hit that high note in your youth?
I adored the opportunity to sing that high note. It's every chorister's dream.
I bet.
Frank, you had a number of jobs after you did your degree, including selling perfume at Selfridges. Then you managed to get a job as an investment banker, which is perhaps surprising.
It is. I mean, all I had to offer was my Arabic. I didn't understand a word of what people were talking about, all these floating rate notes and 2 basis points beneath LIBID and so on. But you pick it up fairly quickly. I didn't do that for that long. I got recruited by Fleming's, a small Scottish bank, and sent to Bahrain. So I was there for the Gulf War, which was immensely frustrating because by then I had several years Territorial Army experience and Arabic. But the bank said, if we find out you volunteered to serve in the Gulf War, this was the first one, the 91 war that pushed Iraq out of Kuwait. It was the good war, as opposed to 2003, which was the wrong war. If we find out you have volunteered, then there's no more a job for you. I later found out the person telling me this used to be in the Scots Guards. He was desperately trying to get called up himself.
So you went armed with gas masks and Hazchem suits?
Yeah, that's right. I had to go over to the Scots Guards barracks in Hounslow, draw out a bit of kit, and when the plane stopped in Bahrain on its way to Oman, I think it was Muscat, I was the only person to get out. So this would have been about August the 3rd, 1990, roughly one day, maybe two, after Saddam Hussein of Iraq had invaded Kuwait. And there was a joke at the time about that, you know, Kuwait, I took it in one day. Bahrain, I will take it by fax, you know, because it's tiny. I just remember there was a sign in the airport of a certain Japanese bank, I'm not going to name them, saying such and such, your reliable friends in the Middle East. And beneath it was this long queue of Japanese bankers all desperately trying to get out. Bahrain was never going to be overrun. It was, you know, as soon as the US Air Force arrived, they were safe. And it was a fascinating time, though, because I got to meet some of the RAF guys during that war. It was extraordinary. By night, they'd be flying these unbelievably dangerous combat missions in their Tornadoes. And as you know, some of them got shot down and survived. By day, they'd be sitting around the pool at the Sheraton, playing backgammon and chatting up flight attendants from Gulf Air.
By the age of 33, you'd become director, but were summoned back to the UK, where I think probably you were beginning to become a little bit disillusioned with the job.
I think it was mutual. I was good at it out there. I brought in over $2 billion worth of business for them, of funds under management. I didn't get to pocket $2 billion myself, sadly. But back in London, I hated the job. I suddenly realised, God, this is it. I'm a banker and this isn't me. So we parted on very good terms, and it was the kick up the backside I needed to switch over to journalism, because that's what I really wanted to do.
We're going to return to your love of birds in one sense, because the next piece is inspired by one.
Oh, yes, it is, yeah. I mean, who doesn't like the lark ascending? There's something else about this piece, though, which is terribly poignant. My mother said to me, it spoke of an age of innocence in Britain before the First World War. I mean, historically, that's probably not correct, but it's what made her think of it. First World War broke out in August 1914. People were racing to get to the recruiting office because they didn't want to miss it. They thought it would all be over by the autumn. And, of course, it dragged on for 4 years into the most atrocious, horrific trench warfare with gas and tanks and barbed wire and mines and shells and hideous wounds.
That misconception, in a way, is wonderfully characterised by poets like Sassoon and Owen, isn't it? What it was really like when you got there. So this music helps transcend it in a way, but also reminds one of the poignancy.
In 2016, BBC Springwatch asked me to present a programme on the centenary of the Battle of the Somme. And my grandfather fought in the Somme. Well, I say fought. He served there. He was an artillery logistics officer. So his job was making sure that the Rhines got brought up to the front. And we went to Mamet's Wood, which had been absolutely shell-blasted. Tolkien was there in 1916. And they preserved some of the trenches. And I thought, my grandfather, who survived the Somme, quite possibly was in one of these trenches overseeing the ammunition coming up. He got a mention in dispatches for it. And then the wonderful thing was that that wood that was completely shell-shattered had grown into this beautiful French copse with golden orioles and hawfinches and lovely blackcaps singing their silvery note. And then out in the fields, the larks with their same song that the troops would have heard in the trenches at the time.
The Lark Ascending by Vaughan Williams, performed by Nicola Benedetti and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Litton. Frank Gardner, by 1999, you were appointed Middle East correspondent in Cairo. With the terrorist threat from al-Qaeda growing in the wake of 9/11, you returned to the UK and became the BBC's security correspondent. But on the 6th of June 2004, you were filming in a suburb in Riyadh where gun battles had just taken place between police and militants, and you yourself came under attack.
Yeah, it wasn't a random drive-by shooting, as some people reported. It was bad luck. We were escorted by Saudi government minders from the Ministry of Information who didn't know what they were doing. They were incompetent and they took us to an area that was far too dangerous. We should either not have gone there at all or had a police escort. It looked peaceful enough, but then by bad luck, al-Qaeda's main team in the country happened to be driving past on their way to go and plot death and destruction. This was a team that had already killed lots of Saudis. You know, they called themselves Muslims, but they'd killed lots of Muslims. They spotted us and their commander divided them into two teams. He said, right, you take out the cameraman, you take out the reporter. I mean, I remember every single detail of it. I was very, very lucky to survive that, thanks to a brilliant South African surgeon who had worked in Cape Town running a trauma team. So he knew a lot about gunshot wound injury. So his expertise saved me. And the first thing I said when I came around was, where is Simon? And my wife was at the bedside and she said, I'm sorry, he didn't make it. And that is so tragic.
The gunmen came over to you and shot you from quite close range several times. Do you think the fact that they found a little copy of the Quran helped in any way?
It made absolutely no difference whatsoever. Having decided that putting several bullets into me was enough to finish me off, the adrenaline or cortisone or whatever it was absolutely pumping through my veins at max, you know, speed. So I was wide awake. I knew the pain was going to come soon, but not yet. And I turned over, lay dead, closed my eyes, stopped breathing, didn't move a muscle. They came and searched my back pockets. They found the receiver so I could do a walking piece to camera in one pocket and a miniature Quran, which I was planning to give as a present, in the other pocket. So it made no difference whatsoever. As far as they were concerned, I was dead. And they managed to miss at point-blank range. These are people standing over me, firing into me, and some of the bullets, the Saudi detective said, were embedded in the road and hadn't gone through me.
And then awful to think that you actually had to lie there for quite a long time before anybody came along and did something.
I waited till I could hear their vehicle drive off, and I waited another minute after that to be safe. Then I rolled over, sat up, my legs flopped uselessly, and I thought, I'll need a bit of physio. I had no idea at that stage that my legs were already paralysed. And I looked down, I could see that there was blood coming out from my midriff. I thought, you know, I'm in trouble here. And the first people to turn up were the local people from that part of town who were not friendly at all. They discussed me like a piece of meat. Fortunately, the police then turned up, but didn't give me any first aid at all. Nobody dared touch me because Saudi Arabia is one of those places. It may have changed, but certainly back in 2004, weirdly, if somebody had touched me, propped me up, given me a bit of comfort, glass of water, anything, and I'd then died, they would go to prison while it was being investigated and they'd be a suspect in my death.
And so, you very nearly did die.
Well, yeah. Eventually, I was screaming so loudly from the pain that the Saudi police bundled me in the back of a police car, drove off at breakneck speed. I was in agony over rough ground, took me to a local hospital where they didn't know what they were doing. I screamed for painkiller. I went under, but I was told that they were trying to patch up my shoulder. I was never going to die from a bullet wound in my shoulder. I was dying from the internal injuries. And fortunately, I had told people I'm British. So they got word to the British Embassy, and Sherrod Cooper Coles, the ambassador, got somebody to inform the governor, who is now the king. And he said, we'll put our best medical team onto it. And they did. And I'm grateful to the Saudis for that. What I'm not grateful to them for is that I was promised compensation by the Saudi ambassador. He gave me his word here. I never received a penny. But then again, Saudi Arabia is desperately short of money. You know, it's not like they've got oil or anything like that.
Your then wife, Amanda, flew out from the UK and must have been pretty appalled by what she found.
She was very brave. She landed at about midnight. She said, take me to the hospital in case I died that night. And I was still in a coma. And, you know, looking at the photograph now of what she would have seen, I mean, I was laid out like a corpse with stuff down my throat, artificial lung to keep me breathing, so many tubes and patches and stuff. And, you know, the last time she'd seen me, I'd waltzed out of our house in London, rucksack on my shoulder, say, I'll be back in a week. And that was the last time she saw me walking.
Obviously, you couldn't listen to anything very much at that point. But later, did music offer some sort of balm?
Definitely, yes. So when I was in the Royal London Hospital, one of the things that massively cheered me up was listening to a waltz by somebody called Emil Waldteufel, which I suppose in German must mean wood devil, but anyway, he was an Alsacian. But it reminded me so much of Bavaria. Twice a year, I would go and lecture at the native school in Oberammergau in Bavaria on what we, the media, want from them, the military. And I loved Bavaria. You know, it was window boxes and wonderful, rich, unhealthy food, probably. But, you know, this wonderful sound of music landscape. And this music reminded me of that. Oh, I love that. Absolutely takes you to the skating rink, doesn't it? Or the rivers.
It's another piece that brought smiles to our
yes.
lips almost simultaneously. The Skater's Waltz by Emil Waldteufel, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. You are clearly, Frank Gardner, a very physical person, climbing mountains, travelling to wild exotic places, and I wonder how you dealt with being told that you wouldn't be able to regain the use of your legs.
I just have to accept it. When I was in hospital, they decided we'd better have somebody have a look at his head. You know, I mean, not physically, but mentally. And this woman sat on the end of my bed and said, So, it was a car accident, was it? And I sent her away. I said, look, if you can't be bothered to read the notes, I'm not opening up to you. So a few days later, they sent this wonderful guy called Professor Neil Greenberg, who is today still the go-to guy on people who've suffered hostage trauma, things like that. And I remember he gave me, I mean, I blubbed my eyes out. I said, oh, I'm never going to be able to run into the sea with my daughters and chase them up trees. And he said, you've done all of that. Don't waste any mental energy on all of that. Concentrate on the things that you can still do and don't mourn the things. Well, do it, but mourn it briefly and then move on. And it was such good advice. It's true. I mean, you know, I've found that I've kind of salvaged more than I expected. I worked hard in the gym with a very good physio. I had a Kiwi physio. And she said, right, I never want to see you leaning back on the back of the wheelchair. Hold yourself upright. And she made me work hard in the swimming pool. I haven't been to a gym now for about 15 years, and you know I'm proud of that because I don't need to. I'm in constant motion. Mm. So last year when I was in Antarctica, I was on a French expedition ship. I said, I want to do kayaking, if that's what everyone else is going to be doing. Oh, ce n'est pas possible, c'est un handicapé, c'est un problème. And so I showed them a short video of me skiing, where I do adaptive skiing. I basically sit inside what is essentially a wheelchair without wheels, mounted on a hydraulic spring and on a single mono carving ski. Before my injuries, I was a poor to average skier. Typical Brit, arms everywhere, windmill around.
There we go. I know the feeling.
Yeah, let's get down this slope any which way. Now I'm closer to the ground, so I'm a much better skier. I've got much more rhythm. So I showed the French expedition leaders this little video of me skiing, and they said, okay, you know, you've got upper body trunk control, that's fine. We will trust you in the water. We canoed for hours around an entire iceberg, around a huge, great big island. The thrill of being there in that sub-zero air and exercising your body at the same time. I mean, still straining my legs for what little muscle power I've got left in them, but letting my arms do all the work. And at the same time, seeing all this marine life around you. You know, we'd pass a small iceberg and there would be a leopard seal that was just dozing there, having eaten its meal. And it was thrilling. It was a wonderful time, that. So I ski, I scuba dive, I still be as physical as I can.
Yeah. It's 20 years on now, and I absolutely understand that you don't want to feel your life has been permanently defined by the attack. But you did in 2020 make a very candid and moving documentary called Being Frank about what it's like to suddenly become disabled. And you talked about the impact that this had on your then wife, Amanda, too.
Yeah, I think people often forget that, you know, when someone suffers a catastrophic injury or a life-changing injury and illness, it has kind of concentric circles that spread out from there. It's not just that person. Often the person most affected is their nearest and dearest, the one who is suddenly, unwillingly, having to turn into partially their carer. And she was brilliant in writing the overturned ship that was our family, and saying, you know, you need to relearn how to ski so that we can go on ski holidays. You need to get yourself back to health. And she was immensely patient when I came out of hospital. And also, she could see things that I couldn't see, that it was going to be impossible for us to stay on in the house that we lived because there were too many stairs. And, you know, I was still sort of clinging to the hope that I would get my legs back. Well, let's see, you know. She'd heard the prognosis of the spinal injury doctors, you know, which is, sorry, he's not going to get to walk again.
Very difficult to survive that, but you've remained very good friends.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Debussy next.
Claire de Lune, I know it's a very often played piece. My daughter works in Cambridge, but she often comes back at the weekends, and there is nothing lovelier than to wake up on a Saturday morning hearing your daughter playing Clair de Lune in the next door room.
Clair de Lune by Debussy, performed by Jean-Éphelin Bavouzet. It must be awfully nice to hear one of your family playing that.
Oh, it's lovely. And I love the fact that the piano has, well, it skipped a generation. I mean, I was taught piano by the mother of somebody very famous. She was horrid. If you got a note wrong, she slapped your hand. I was four, and it put me off playing for life. But I'm so thrilled that my daughter does. So she has effectively inherited my father's grand piano and loves playing it.
In recent years, Frank Gardner, you've turned your hand to fiction writing, using your knowledge of espionage to write books about a Secret Service operative called...
Luke Carlton.
Any part of you in Luke, do you think?
I mean, occasionally, yes, his internal thoughts are saying, oh, for goodness sake, this is nonsense, let's just get on with this or whatever. Luke Carlton is not the sort of classic cliché James Bond or even Jason Bourne. He teams up with an extremely smart operative who is the intelligence agency's go-to expert on CBRN, on chemical, biological, radiological and nuclear weapons. She's Jenny Lee, she's British-Chinese, and they form a very good partnership. So they go out on missions together.
Well, music next, Frank, by a composer whose life was made really quite miserable by state security services.
Yes, you're talking about the Russian state security service.
Of course.
Shostakovich. So this is Waltz number 2 from the Jazz Suite. And I think I probably first heard this when we watched Eyes Wide Shut, the film with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman. They're getting ready to go to a party. And yes, they seem to be this very stable couple, but the music tells you all is not right, that something sinister is going to be happening. And it's got that wonderful frisson of almost sexual intrigue. Yes, it's a waltz and you can dance to it, but there's something dark happening here. Thank you.
Waltz No. 2 from the Jazz Suite, composed by Shostakovich, performed by the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra, conducted by Ricardo Chailly. Frank, you've been talking about your bird watching, and in 2016 you went with explorer Benedict Allen, who's also done this programme, to Papua New Guinea. Were you in search of a particular creature?
Well, I was in search of birds of paradise, of which there are over 30. When I was lying weak and despondent in hospital, it was a grim time. I was 7 months in hospital, 14 surgical operations. I got so sick, I don't really want to see the inside of a hospital again if I can help it. And I thought, damn, why didn't I go to Papua New Guinea when I could? And I had to wait another 12 years. And it was quite dodge, some of it. I mean, I had to be carried in a kind of palanquin-type thing by these incredibly strong Papuans who would be in relays, because as you pass through one clan's area, once you passed into the other, you had to hand over to them. And they were always at war with each other. So there was always the danger that could break out. But it wasn't just that. It was that we were going along the edge of pretty steep ravines. And I had to trust that those guys weren't going to miss their footing. Because if they did, they'd be OK. But I wouldn't. I would roll off that and roll right down the ravine. I wouldn't be able to save myself.
Frank, you've been reporting for nearly three decades now. And I suppose finally I'm just wondering, do you think the life of a reporter is much more difficult than when you started out, or because of technology, is it much easier?
It's much easier. And thanks to smartphones, we can all film stuff, we can record stuff, we can send stuff from the field very easily. Nowadays, you can do whatever it is you want to do. Just get the tech skills and develop a USP, if you can, a unique selling point.
We could go on talking for hours very happily.
We have already.
We've got to draw to a close. So I'm wondering what piece you'd like to play out on.
Well, my mother, as I said, was a great influence on me musically. To my surprise, it wasn't just classical. She introduced me to Fats Waller, and we both loved listening to Fats Waller. He has such a kind of jaunty sense of humour. Obviously, his music is brilliant, it's funny, it's uplifting, and it just brings a smile to your face.
We're going to end then with Ain't Misbehavin', Frank Gardner. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ain't Misbehaving, performed by Fats Waller, with lyrics by Andy Razaf and music by Harry Brooks and Fats Waller, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the BBC security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael will be talking to the writer Olivia Leng. Next on Radio 3, Sarah Moore-Peach maps the musical terrain around The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
This is where it begins, here.
On BBC iPlayer, you'll find what you love.
Here comes the cavalry.
I'm Detective Sergeant Rebus.
And love what you find.
Oh my gosh, it's all come down to me. Who do I choose?
Discover gripping thrillers.
You serious?
Yes, looking good, actually.
Or comedy box sets.
Oh yeah, very good.
I'll bring my kids, make a day of it.
Live stream BBC TV.
Unbelievable!
And binge watch brilliant shows.
This is good. We're going to have some fun.
The best way to watch TV.
Push the button.
BBC iPlayer.
This is Radio 3. Hannah French is here with the early music show at 5, and today she talks to Japanese organist and conductor Masaaki Suzuki on his 70th birthday. Before that, at 4, it's Jazz Record Requests with Alan Shipton, marking the centenary of saxophonist Lucky Thompson. And at 3 o'clock, join us for Choral Evensong from York Minster. But now it's 1:30 and time to join Sarah Moore-Peach on her Sunday afternoon musical journey.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we take a single piece of classical music as our destination and work our way towards it through a playlist of connections, stretching our ears across time and space and tugging on those mysterious threads that seem to connect all music together. Today, we're exploring The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which, depending on your perspective, is either a fantastic late 19th century French tone poem or one of Walt Disney's greatest hits. The Sorcerer's Apprentice by the French composer Paul Ducasse, popularised by Walt Disney, whose animation studio used it for Mickey Mouse's comeback in the 1940 film Fantasia, and we'll come to that later. But let's kick things off by meeting some other musical magicians. Here's one who's possibly even more famous than Mickey Mouse.